Well, and we can't forget the name Marco Polo, can we? We used to play that as a kid, didn't we? We'll be back in a moment with Gunnar Thompson on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our special guest, Gunnar Thompson. We'll take some of your phone calls. Gunnar, Marco Polo, what is his role in all of this?
Marco Polo, as far as historians are concerned, may or may not have traveled to China. A couple of years ago, British historian Frances Wood wrote a book saying, or she asked the question, did Marco Polo actually go to China? And that was because the book that he dictated in about the year 1298 in Genoa, he forgot to mention things like the Great Wall of China, tea ceremony, foot binding, and some other things. And so Frances Wood said, well, it's possible that Marco Polo never went to China. And there's a number of modern historians that have sort of subscribed to this idea, that basically they don't like Marco Polo, partly because he's one of these fringe explorers who may actually have traveled across the Pacific Ocean. And I've done enough research and have come up with some Marco Polo maps, one of which is actually in the archives, the locked archives of the Library of Congress, a map that Marco Polo brought back from China showing Alaska and the West Coast. Now, historians don't like to talk about this, but there's actually a congruence of evidence between things that Marco Polo mentions in his book and the Marco Polo maps that show New World territories. One of the things that Marco Polo says in his book is that the Chinese merchants sailed on year-long voyages east of Japan to territories where they traded, and the only territories on mainland that Chinese merchants could have traded east of Japan would have to be in someplace in North America or perhaps Central America. Marco Polo also mentions that he traveled for 40 days east of Siberia, and if you're in Siberia and you travel 40 days east by ship, it's going to take you into the Canadian Arctic.
That's right.
So There's actually ample evidence in maps and in what Marco Polo had to say that he had traveled to the New World. Now, the question that we ask then is how come these maps weren't made available in the popular book of Marco Polo's travels? And the reason is that the Venetian government regarded any overseas voyaging as potentially a risk to their own economic security. The Venetians depended upon maritime commerce for their income, and any knowledge of overseas resources or lands that they could keep secret meant that they have that advantage over other territories in Italy. And so once Marco Polo came back with these Chinese maps, they were promptly confiscated and he was sworn to secrecy.
I want to address the conspiracy again for a moment before we go to some of these calls, Gunnar. In your opinion, why is it so difficult for them to either attempt to get to the truth or at least try to investigate some of the things you've talked about tonight?
Well, one reason is their academic training. A lot of people have been brought up with the dogma that says anybody that disagrees with the standing paradigm has got to be a hoaxer or a charlatan. And so there's an immediate tendency not to bother to look at the evidence. Galileo ran into the same kind of problem when he tried to get some of the prelates, the theologians, the church authorities to look through his telescope at the moons of Jupiter. Galileo would say, well, this proves that I'm right. And they would say, well, we don't want to look through your telescope because we think it's a device of the devil. So when you've got this built-in dogma in academia, this loyalty to a paradigm or doctrine, people actually can't see what's right before their faces, or they refuse to look.
All right, let's go to some of the calls. International Line, where are you calling from? You're on Coast to Coast with us.
Hi, are you talking to me?
Yes, sir.
I was just wondering, I'm calling from Winnipeg. I was just wondering about how continental drift has to play in this.
Continental drift, interesting question. Yeah. Gunnar?
Well, I actually think continental drift is quite relevant because when I was in the University of Illinois, my geology professor told me and everyone else in class to be on the lookout for a crackpot named Alfred Wegener, who had this theory about continental drift, that the reason why the outline of the continents on the east coast of North and South America looked so similar to the reverse outline of the continents of Europe and Africa Wegener suggested that it was because the continents were drifting apart. And my geology professor said that this is absolutely impossible. If the continents were drifting apart, he would be able to see it. Now, the continents drifted apart, as far as we know, at least 100, 200 million years ago. So this was long before people were walking across. That's pretty much what I would have to say about continental drift.
Okay, next up, west of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast with Gunnar Thompson. Hi there.
Hi. My name is Melissa, and I'm calling from Wichita, Kansas.
Okay, Melissa, thanks for calling.
Hi. Mr. Thompson, I read the book 1421, and I thought a lot of it was very concrete, and some of it was very suppositional. You could make the case for it, for or against, but two of the pieces that I thought were concrete were all the archaeological evidence in Australia that proves that the Chinese were there long before Cook, and the other one was Magellan's map. He put down a near mutiny by his crew because they were so afraid that he was going nowhere, and he proved to them he knew where he was going because he already had a map, and if he had a map, where did it come from?
Right. And you might recall, Melissa, that Columbus did about the same thing. His crew was near mutiny, and he said, no, just stay with me for another couple days, and we'll be there. And
right.
Suddenly the land appears. And that was one of the issues that Gavin Menzies and I discussed a couple years ago when we first met, was that in the reading that he had done, all the explorers, including James Cook, mentioned that they already had maps of where they were going. And these maps turned out to be copies of the 1418 Ming Chinese map that found their way to Venice and Portugal and then were used by a number of the explorers.
Yes. And the archaeological evidence in Australia, I believe that the textbook material that, you know, is so frustrating for you to be so inaccurate, I believe that that is slowly going to change. Because I think there's just no doubt that they were there. I don't think anybody can prove otherwise. Could you talk more about the archaeological evidence in Australia?
Oh, the archaeological evidence in Australia. Not very much. I'm just basically what Menzies has in his book are mentioning a number of figurines that were found in northern Australia, as I recall, that are Ming Chinese, and suggesting that this was evidence of the Ming voyagers. If you look at the 1418 map that's on the Coast to Coast website, you'll also see that Australia is shown on this map, and it was known to the Chinese. So certainly before Magellan sails, on the Ming map, we have a depiction of Australia. And according to the Western historians, Australia was discovered by Dutch explorers, the Tasman, and then pretty much filled in by James Cook. And we've got a number of Ming and perhaps even earlier Chinese maps that show the entire coast of Australia. So the archaeological evidence is important. DNA evidence is important. The maps, as far as I'm concerned, are conclusive.
How much Egyptian artifacts are there that were found in North America?
Not an awful lot, but there were a couple statuettes found in El Salvador, clearly Egyptian statuettes, a statue of an unknown pharaoh and a statue of Isis, and these were photographed back in the early 1900s. There's also linguistic evidence. The ancient Mexicans used the term ray for the serpent eye of the sun, and ray was also used in Egypt for the expression serpent eye of the sun. There's the evidence on Queen Hatshepsut's mural of the maize and pineapple would probably be identifiable as Central American plants, and so that's back in Egypt. So not an awful lot of evidence, but certainly some.
Okay, next up, let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
We're doing great. Thank you.
I, I have two questions, actually. One's more substantial than the other. The other is a bit existential.
Okay.
First question is, I took a vacation travel trip to Plymouth, Rhode Island, Plymouth, Massachusetts. And upon going there, we came across this very small museum that we, without even trying to, we were there for some other American reasons. They happened to have on display a reed boat that they claimed was dated at 3,000 years ago. I was wondering if you know anything about some of the museums or in your research that you've done, some of the things that have been brought up as such. They claimed that it was an Egyptian reed boat. And my second question, which is a more existential one, is upon your research of researching the maps and such, have you ever come across anything regarding to Atlantis?
Good questions. Reed boat first.
Yeah, the reed boat first. Well, I'd like to see the museum exhibit. My first guess would be that they got a hold of a boat from the Lake Titicaca region, a reed boat, and estimated based on perhaps Thor Heyerdahl's work that the first reed boats in that region could date back 3,000 years. As far as Atlantis, that's been a very intriguing question to me because I have been concerned for a long time about early civilizations, both in the Atlantic and Pacific, Atlantis and Mu, and trying to figure out if there is a correlation between the Egyptian account that's referred to by Plato, I believe it is, and
Plato, of course, the great Greek writer, he did make reference. A lot of people think that Atlantis might have been a smaller region near Greece, but I don't know. I think it might have been something bigger than that.
One of the things that that the account that's mentioned in Plato, and he's referring this back to something that a relative of his acquired from knowledgeable Egyptian elders, was that the land area was close enough to the Mediterranean to be a military threat. So that suggests to me that even though Henrietta Mertz and a number of people have suspected that ancient America was Atlantis, that it was an area that had sunk underneath the water. And that sort of correlates to the tale of Atlantis, that it had sunk underwater. So it suggests to me one of these huge continental areas or shelf coastal areas that sank in the melting glaciers of the last ice age, which would place it about at the right time, about 10,000 years ago. Now, off the coast of Scotland, off the east coast, there is a depression in the continental shelf in that area. It's called Devil's Hole. And this could relate to a meteorite impact, which could once again get back to the legend of Atlantis, that the disaster occurred about at the time that there was a meteorite impact. But what also strikes me in looking at the sonar, the underwater sonar charts of the shelf area southeast of the Thames River, there's glacial moraines. And these glacial moraines create a concentric pattern. And one of the things, the really peculiar things in the account of Atlantis was that the capital was built up on concentric islands. And so I suspect that all of the necessary factors for a land area that meets all of the specifics in Plato's account is right in the shelf area between England and France. And I would sure as heck like to do some underwater archaeology in that area.
When do you think continental drift really started taking effect? Well, you think it was millions of years ago, or maybe it was much earlier here, much later, rather?
Oh, well, it's still going on, but as my geology professor suggested, it wasn't rapid enough for him to be able to see it actually happening. I think scientists calculate that it's maybe a couple inches a year at most, and they figure that the greatest drift took part about between 200 and 300 million years ago. And this is based on dating the magnetic changes and the sediments of the seafloor. And I suspect what happened as a mechanism for this was that either a number of asteroids, meteorites, or perhaps a moon, perhaps maybe the thickness of an eighth of the diameter of the Earth, crashed into the Earth. And by increasing the mass of Earth and thus the surface area of the Earth, the continents were thrown apart in an effort to try to reestablish equilibrium. If you've got a spinning ball and you put something on the surface, it's going to run around the surface of that spinning ball to try to essentially establish equilibrium with the centrifugal force.
Gunnar, if we changed history, if we merely said, all right, we believe that the Americas were visited thousands of years ago by other civilizations, how would that affect us?
Well, for example, one of the things that would change would be instead of celebrating Discovery Day, which is a Eurocentric mm-hmm. holiday, if we had a generic Discovery Day and we recognized that all the major maritime civilizations, multi-ethnic groups were involved in this, it would essentially bring everyone to the same table. Right now, we have a history that's dominated by white males, and we've even pretty effectively excluded the important roles of women in world discovery.
Do you think all that was done by design?
Well, it was
just a sign of the times.
Maybe. Well, it was definitely done by design, but the history establishment that we've inherited originated in the Middle Ages from priests that were taught how to write, and eventually they decided, let's make a story of role of Europeans in world evangelism, and this is the heritage of Western history. Those historians weren't interested in what the Chinese were doing, or what the West Africans were doing, or what the Japanese, or the ancient Celtics, or the Britons, or the Phoenicians, or the Greeks were doing. They were only interested in the role of world evangelism, and Columbus played a vital role in that. He was the leading hero. And there was also a belief that the world was going to end very shortly, perhaps in the year 1500. And with this perspective of history, which is very narrow-minded, narrow-sighted, short-sighted, you don't need to have an all-inclusive history of the entire world and all its peoples. But if you figure that the world's going to go on and on for many thousands or millions of years, and we're going to all have to learn to get along with each other, we need a foundation of knowledge of our past that brings everybody to the same table.
All right. Well, your websites, of course, I think we're getting through to them now. MarcoPoloVoyages.com. In the book, Secret Voyages to the New World, where do you get it, Gunnar?
I would suggest ordering that through Glenn Kimball's website, which is ancientmanuscripts.com. Glenn has got a lot of other books that relate to ancient manuscripts, and it would be a good source to get the book.
All right, stay with us. We're going to take final phone calls with our guest Gunnar Thompson in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We'll take some fast blast questions when we come back, and also the rest of your phone calls next hour. Open lines here on Coast to Coast AM. Gunnar, Mike from Dallas wants to know about the ancient Vikings, if you believe they made it to the Americas before a lot of people.
Absolutely. The historians have generally said that the only people before Columbus that reached the Americas were the Vikings. And then they usually add, but they did nothing of significance. The reality is there's a substantial evidence that there were Norwegian settlements, Christian settlements, and then subsequently pagan settlements that went all the way into New York State. The region was referred to in the sagas as Vinland det Goda, or Vinland the Good. But in 1261, King Haakon of Norway declared sovereignty over all the lands, as he said, from the Baltic to the North Pole. And this land region was called Land Anew, or the New Land. And what was going on was the Norwegians were going to try some sleight of hand. Germans, the Irish, Brits had sailed across the Atlantic to the Newfoundland region, the New York, Massachusetts region for quite some time as merchants. And the Norwegians, under Haakon IV, had strong enough military power to take over this region. And they decided to call it New Land and say it was located up around the North Pole as a way of trying to confuse Europeans and therefore maintain their sovereignty over this region. And it's one of the reasons why the Portuguese and the Venetians had an alliance, was they were going to try to get into this sacred or exclusive Norwegian territory.
Distorting of these ancient maps, why did they distort them?
Well, one distortion, for example, was the Norwegians put the lands in the west, Massachusetts, New York, the place that was called Vinland, is actually straight west of Norway. They put it up around the North Pole. Now, there was some logic behind that because using the north, or using a magnetic compass, if you sailed north by compass bearings from England, it takes you straight to Ireland, straight to Iceland, and then if you still go straight north by compass, it takes you to the Newfoundland region, which is actually west of Norway. So the effect of magnetic variation on the compass made it appear as though lands that were west of Norway should be situated around the North Pole. Norwegian geographers probably realized that this was an error resulting from the magnetic compass. They showed these lands around the North Pole because it was a way of concealing the identity of these lands from other Europeans. And part of the reason for doing that, for example, was King Arthur had been over to Nova Scotia to establish colonies in the 500s, and the Norwegians wanted to try to confuse the Europeans. So one of the reasons for the distortions was essentially commercial espionage.
Okay, next up, let's go back to the phones. We'll go to our West of the Rockies line. You're on with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George. Hi, Gunnar. I wanted to relate to you guys. I was listening to you there a minute ago.
Sure.
Talking about Newfoundland. And in 1997, our family went to Newfoundland for the commemoration ceremonies in 1497, John Cabot sailed into Newfoundland, and they actually reconstructed the ship, the Matthew and everything, and it sailed into the harbor at night with all these lights shining on it. It looked like a ghost ship, you know, and it was wonderful. I mean, a really neat ceremony. And then we rented a car and drove around, and you could see all these Viking camps where they used to be, and they were all over, just like Gunnar said. They had actually some of their houses reconstructed so that you could see how they lived in there and everything. But Newfoundland people are wonderful. I mean, they're just so funny. But that's what I wanted to tell you guys.
Thank you.
Okay, I appreciate your comments. Next up, East of the Rockies, your turn. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, good morning, gentlemen.
Hi.
I wonder if, Gunnar, can you give any credibility to stories about the Jewish refugees from the destruction of Jerusalem actually getting as far away from the Romans as the Ohio River Valley?
Oh, absolutely. All across the southeastern United States, people have come across what's referred to as Bar Kokhba coins that were minted in ancient Palestine by the Jews and brought over with them as refugees. And there's also Roman coins from about the same time period. Probably the Jews who are generally related, at least to some extent, to the Phoenicians, were the principal merchants that were sailing across the seas. And so when the Romans put down the rebellion in Lebanon and in that region, one of the natural places for the Jews to flee to on ships that the merchants were using that were familiar to them was across the seas to the southeastern United States and into the Ohio River Valley.
Okay, thanks. Appreciate that. That's fascinating. I didn't know that, Gunnar. I didn't know that at all. International line, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Oh, hi. My name is Derek. I'm calling from Mississauga, which is just outside Toronto, Ontario.
Sure, Derek.
Great topic tonight. I wanted to ask your guest. I read a lot of the Clive Cussler novels, and in his novels, he puts forward a lot of theories similar to what I'm hearing tonight. like in one, The Treasure of the Khan, he puts forth the idea that Kublai Khan's burial place is actually off the Hawaiian Islands. And in Trojan Odyssey, he puts forth the idea that Troy was actually off the British Isles. And what your guest is saying tonight, I used to think Cussler stories were pure fantasy, but it kind of dovetails very nicely with what Gunnar is saying.
Definitely, Derek. There's a an Italian author, I believe his name is Vincent, who's recently done research on the place names around the Baltic Sea, and he finds a great similarity of the place names around the Baltic Sea and the legends of Troy. And specifically, there's mention in the legends of Troy about a battle that lasted in daylight hours for essentially the equivalent of several days in a row. And a place, one place where you run into daylight hours that run the equivalent of several days in a row is the land of the midnight sun, which would be in the area of Sweden. So definitely there was a lot of overseas traveling that has been missed by the modern historians. You're right, Derek.
You know, what's incredible is how so much we have missed. I mean, it really makes you wonder what's been going on this planet, Gunnar, for a long time.
I know, and it's a tremendous fun to for a time detective like myself to look for the clues and piece together the evidence, and surprisingly, a lot of that evidence is sitting right beneath the noses of people that call themselves scientists. And I think one of the reasons for that is some of the people that study the brain, for example, talk about right brain or left brain, or people that are more oriented towards language versus people that are more oriented towards art and form and music and whatnot. And so people that whose brains are pretty much over in one area just can't see stuff that maybe artists or poets see. And that's perhaps one of the reasons why that stuff has been missed.
Let's go to our wild card line. You're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George. Shane here. I'm calling from Melbourne, Australia.
Well, thank you, Shane. Go ahead.
Gunnar may not know about the two Egyptian shipwrecks found off the coast of England back in 1939, which were radiocarbon dated to 1500 BC. And they're in the basement of the Hull Museum at this present day.
I'm not aware of it, Gunnar.
I have come across some evidence of Egyptian and Roman activity in the Australia region.
This is actually off the coast of England.
Of England.
In the home, it's in the Hull Museum in the basement department.
Well, what'd they do, bury it down there?
Well, it was radiocarbon back in the early 50s to 1500 BC, and they said impossible.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, it was impossible, wasn't it?
Yeah. Thought you'd find it interesting.
No, thanks, George. It is. I have found some fantastic stuff in the British Museum, but obviously I need to go back and look in the basement.
Check that out. How come, Shane, how come they don't bring that thing out to the world?
It would jeopardize too many professional positions, I think.
Let's go to our wild card line. You're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there. Good morning.
Yes, sir. This is Bear from Leavenworth, Kansas.
Hi, Bear.
I was looking into some Southwest Native American tribes, doing some history, and I found a story about two scientists, a G.E. Kincaid and a Professor S.A. Jordan. Now, your guest Gunnar was talking about finding things that didn't quite fit in the area, like pineapple pictures in Egypt.
And maize and things like that, yes.
Well, supposedly these two found, like, Egyptian artifacts in the Grand Canyon. I was wondering if your guest knew anything about that.
What I recall reading about, it's been a while, were some caves that some people had found essentially mummies and some Egyptian writing. And there were similar caves reported, I believe, someplace in the Ohio, Kentucky area back in the early days of the pioneers, someone came across mummified remains and what appeared to be ancient Greek, Roman, or Egyptian writing.
I mean, it is possible, Gunnar, that ancient civilizations, let's say from the 15th century, may have brought them over. That's possible, right?
Well,
is that a yes or a no?
Well, this is one of those things that one needs to get as much evidence as possible to before drawing a conclusion.
Sure. I mean, because anything's possible.
There's a tremendous number of artifacts that have cropped up in the Midwest attributed to a place called Burroughs Cave, and a lot of these appear to me to be materials that probably predate the pioneers, but aren't as ancient as one might seem to think. They look to me like something that was created a little bit later. Somebody might have gotten a hold of a book of ancient symbols, for example, and then use those symbols to make some artifacts for religious purposes that come somewhat after the actual invention of those symbols. So there is a discrepancy then between in the dating, and so you're right. It is in some cases it is possible that a number of these things that we find that look Egyptian or Greek or Roman or whatnot could have been brought over later. But this is where the importance of an actual field archaeologist comes in.
Sure.
Is that the field archaeologist is supposed to look for things that are intrusive versus things that are under specific layers of datable deposits, whether it's soil or for example, a Roman ceramic head was found beneath a cement floor inside of a Mexican pyramid. Well, you know for sure if you can date the floor, and I think the floor in that Mexican pyramid was the 10th century. The head was 2nd century. So here there's a little bit of discrepancy between the artifact and the layer that it's found in, but it certainly is long before Columbus.
Let's go to our west of the Rockies. You're up with us. Hello there. Good morning. Hello.
Hello, John Crosby.
Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, I'm from Leamington, Ontario, Canada, but I'm in Florida right now. I drive a truck. Back in the 70s, I worked with a guy called Victor Roth. He was Jewish, and I used to ask him a lot of questions about Jewish people and history and that. He gave me a book called The Jews, and it was a simple book, but it had a lot of history to it. It was a real thick book, and they said in the book that Jewish people all through history were merchants, and they dealt with people from all around the world and explorers, and they were meticulous in keeping maps and cartography, and a lot of explorers would go to these guys to update themselves on the different maps and that. I just want to know if he can make a comment on it or if he's even heard about that or whatever. But I'll take it off the line. I can hear it better off the line.
Okay, very good. Guy sounds like Dan Aykroyd, too, doesn't he? He did.
Yeah, well, thanks, Victor. And hello to all the truckers out there that are keeping America going at this late hour of the night. Certainly, the Jews and the Phoenicians who traveled, are known to have traveled all over the world, were in very close contact with each other. And it was the belief of the ancient Greeks that the Phoenicians had circumnavigated the earth sometime between 500 and 1,000 years B.C. As far as the maps, the Jews in the 15th century were among the most reliable map makers that were used by the Portuguese and other Europeans. And one of the oldest maps that survived from this period, the Catalan Atlas of about 1375, is thought to be one of the earlier European versions of Marco Polo's voyages. So certainly the Jews were involved in worldwide trading and map making.
In some of your investigations, Gunnar, do you ever come across ancient technology? Not just the fact that they might have traveled earlier, but just true ancient high technology?
Well, certainly one of the most important things of high technology from my standpoint is the telescope. I've determined from illustrations that I found in Europe that the telescope was known to Prince Henry the Navigator, which is by 1420, by the Romans, in an illustration by Matthew Paris in 1250, by the Germans in an illustration from 1493. So certainly the use of the telescope predates Galileo or Leprechy, according to modern historians, supposedly invented the telescope around the year 1600 or 1610. But it also is fairly clear to me that the Chinese were observing sunspots going back to 2,000 or 3,000 years B.C., and I suspect that the telescope was probably in use back at that point in time. The people that are most often, I think, left out of the whole picture are the Arabs, the Persians, the Babylonians did an awful lot of looking at the stars and working on algebra, mathematics, spherical algebra, for example, that can be used for map making. So there is certainly a development of technology that we don't have very much evidence of.
Boy, I mean, we've missed so much, and the conspiracy continues. Do you think they'll ever change things?
I'm hoping this program is going to precipitate a transformation in American education and philosophy.
Very good. And again, thanks for being the guest tonight, Gunnar. The book, Secret Voyages to the New World, and you think we just pick it up on Glenn Kimball's Ancient Manuscripts website?
That would be a good place to get the book, yes.
Okay, great. Thanks, Gunnar. Appreciate you being part of the program. I'll be back in a moment with just pure open lines, but I'm going to open up a special topic line for you because so many people are beginning to feel as if something big is going to happen in the next couple months. I want to restrict this line and your predictions to just 2 months from now. What you think might this be? That's 818-817-0021. The rest of the lines are open, but this one let's hold for the special two-month prediction line. What do you think's going to happen? 818-817-0021. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.